like take it up a notch and talk about a different kind of happiness, because you can see that we're all trying to be happy, but it's really difficult. They say in Buddhism that what you're looking for is not where you're looking in the wrong place. So, you know, people, we've all had enough time to try to be happy, and most of us are not very good at it. We tend to do things which we see here causes misery, and then what do? We do them again and think, well, last time it caused me misery, this time I'll do it differently. Or we just forget the last time it caused misery, and then we do it again and, ooh, the same thing. So it's really not easy. Then we have another aspect of happiness. It's very interesting, which my spiritual master talked about. He said, a lot of times what we call happiness is not happiness. It's just that you've avoided some pain, and relative to not experiencing the pain, you call it happiness. Just like, for example, you think you have cancer, so you get the test, you go to the doctor, you get the report, and he says, you don't have cancer. You feel really good, right? Because it's an absence of something that could have been very painful. Or if right now I went around and banged everyone in the toe with my hammer, which fortunately I won't do, and then I took my magic wand and the pain went away, then I would say, how's your toe feeling? You'd say, wow, it feels good, right? Because there's no more pain. But if I asked you before I did it, how did your toe feel? You'd probably say, I don't know, I didn't really think about it. So the absence of pain relative makes what is normal sometimes feel pleasurable. So he said that what happens for a lot of people is they don't have positive happiness in their life. It's like, thank God it's Friday. That's the happiness. I've removed myself from work. You know, and if you really, you know, I imagine if you really don't like your job, then when Friday evening comes, you're a lot happier than the people who like your job. So-called happy, right? Because relatively, it's a greater relief. So it's an interesting concept if you look at your life and just think, do I do anything in my attempts to be happy, which are really just the space between two miserable things that I could forget, the vacation that I could forget about, the misery, putting my head in the sand so I don't notice it. So that's an interesting aspect of our effort to be happy. It's just an avoidance of it. So, yes?
One thing I was thinking as you were speaking at the beginning is that our happiness is also kind of tainted by the fact that we anticipate it coming to an end, or we're afraid that it's going to come to an end.
Yeah, so even when you're enjoying it, there's anxiety that
I have to go home soon, or you're getting older, and now you're getting sick, and now you're going to die, and you're going to be left alone.
Or like, yeah, a lot of women are with their boyfriend, and they see their boyfriends looking at other girls, and it's like, it creates... Girls, that's what guys do, unfortunately. It doesn't mean they're attracted to do anything to leave you. It's just what they do. So I found a verse in one of our one book called the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's very interesting about happiness. And there was one sadhu, saintly person. He was asked about happiness, and he said, I've come up with a conclusion by studying the world about happiness. And he said, I've seen that the more people try to become happy because they really don't know how to do it, they create their own pain by their effort to be happy. And we talked about that here. You know, so many things we've done, you know. We wanted to be happy, but it didn't end up that way. So he said, I've studied. And he said, that's quite normal. That people create pain in their effort to be happy. They get into wrong relationships, wrong jobs. As we're talking about, they're worried about what other people think, so they acquiesce to them. We do so many wrong things. So he said, I've concluded that the way to be happy is don't try. Because if you don't know how to be happy, the more you try, the worse off you get. And I think that's most people's experience. It's my experience. When I was young, when God was giving out brains, mechanical brains, he skipped me. So anything I tried to fix, that was it. Like my dad saw me trying to fix something, he'd have to come and stop me before I ruin it. So when you don't know how to do something and try to fix it, what happens?
It
gets worse. So a lot of our lives are like that. We don't know how to be happy, we're trying, and then it's actually getting worse. Or as the saying goes, the cure is worse than the disease. you know, yeah. Here, take this medicine. You come back a week later. Hey, I just had a heart attack from your medicine. You know? It's very common in allopathic medicine. The side effects are worse than the disease. You know, there was a strike in Germany by doctors. The mortality rate went down that month, but the doctors weren't practicing. Yeah. If you want to be healthy, my best advice to you is do whatever you can to avoid seeing doctors. That's very good advice. If you can stay away from it. In Chinese medicine, you pay your doctor to keep you healthy.
What's that advice for somebody who's in medical school?
We can do natural
pathology. Yeah. Take your medical thing and then study some alternative. Of course, you know, if people aren't sick, you're going to go out of business. So.
This story, this took place just a few weeks ago. I was talking to a pharmacist who happens to be a practitioner. And he gave me some medication, and I said, is this stuff addictive? And he said, no. And then he said, but even if it was, I wouldn't tell you because we all want you to buy more and more.
Right,
so I wouldn't tell you if it was addictive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Endless addiction. So, interesting thing in the Bhagavad Gita, and there's a verse and it says that when you're in passion, your desires can't be satisfied because every time you try to satisfy one, you'll find another one. So I had some problem with skin cancer and I got this medicine you put on your skin, and what it does is it actually takes off a layer of skin and it bubbles up. And my skin is still red from it. But you don't really see anything for about 3 weeks. And so this doctor said, well, after 3 weeks, do it another 3 weeks. And it gets to the point at the sixth week where it's like, that's it. You can't. It's so itchy. I had to stop at the sixth week. So, but what happened about the fifth week, it was like I had to touch it. And more so than any itch I ever had, the more I touched it, the itchier it got. It was like there was no way out of it. And that's exactly how Krishna describes when we're trying to be happy materially. The more you scratch it, then you want to scratch it more. So we're not getting satisfied. And my spiritual master once said, you scratch, and then there's blood. So that blood is like the ultimate frustration. You know? There's more itching, more itching. Well, what do you get? So I want to do a little visualization to help you with this. So why don't you all close your eyes and imagine that on your back you have an itch. And that itch is really bothering you. And you need to relieve the itch. You need to scratch it. There's one problem. The itch is in that very spot on your back where neither the fingers of your right hand or the fingers of your left hand can reach the itch. So you're trying to get it, and you're about an inch from it, but you can't get it, and you do the other hand and other way, and just pointing. So you can't do it, and it's driving you crazy. So you get your roommate and say, could you scratch? And my back, because I have this itch that's driving me crazy. And you describe to them the exact location, and they begin scratching your back. And for most of us, scratching our back is a great pleasure. But unfortunately, they can't find the itch, and you're just, no, just up a little bit. And they go up, but then they go too high. No, down a little bit. Then they go down to the right too much. No, to the left, just a little bit to the left. And then they go too far to the left. And no, to the right, and then they go too far to the right. And you're going completely crazy. And they're scratching everywhere on your back, but that one spot. And it's itching you. And it's almost torturing you. And you're trying to describe, and more you're describing. Finally, you navigate them, and they hit the spot. And what do you say? Okay, you can open your eyes. And that is an analogy. That itch is actually the soul. And the rest of the back are all the material things we can do to satisfy us. Because did you notice that because that itch wasn't being satisfied, you couldn't enjoy the rest of the back being scratched? Because that was the one spot. So there's so many things enjoyable in this world, but we're missing one thing. And that one thing, if it's not satisfied, then we're trying to satisfy that through everything else. So what happens is, what did we say? If a 1,000-square-foot house isn't good enough, what do? I get a 2,000-square-foot. And so what is that? It's like, well, this vegetable preparation doesn't have enough salt in it. It doesn't taste good, so let's put more salt in it. It doesn't need more salt. It just doesn't taste good. And we keep putting more salt in. So something that doesn't work, what do? We add more of the same thing that didn't work. And that's material life. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this other kind of happiness, because it's very important. Because if we don't understand it, then we end up in this futile attempt. We're always going to be looking for happiness. And then you're going to have relationships, and you're going to blame the other person for you not being happy. Because you put all your eggs in one basket of a relationship. This person's supposed to make you happy. It doesn't work that way. That's not how the world wasn't designed that way, for things and other people to make us happy. There's a certain level of satisfaction, obviously, we get from relationships, from having a good place to live and food and so forth. But it only takes us to a certain level of happiness. You know, they've done surveys and they say that they interviewed people in the city in India called Benares. It's a very spiritual city in India. And they were interviewing people, they're doing a study on happiness. What are the things that create happiness? And so when they advertised the people in Benares, based on the list of the things that would give people happiness, the people they interviewed, because there's so many saintly persons there, didn't have any of those things. Because they think, well, what do you need for happiness? You need, you know, at least a house of this size, a family, this much money in the bank, at least one or two cars, this many kids. So they had their list, and they're asking, do you have this? No. Do you have this? No. Because these are people who are renounced. Right? And they found that the people in Benares, of all the places they've studied, were the happiest people. But they had the least qualifications of what would include, what would make, what you would need the ingredients to be for happiness. It's interesting. And then they did another survey, in London, in Oxford, School of Economics did a survey on happiness levels. I don't know the details of the survey, how they came to their conclusions of the levels of happiness. But out of hundreds, maybe three, I believe 300 countries, America landed 42. Number 42 in the happiness survey. And they say Americans consume, I think it's 30 times more than the average Indian. 30 to 50 times. That we have 30 times more than the average citizen in India. And one of the poorest countries in the world is Bangladesh, and they rated number one in that survey of happiness. So it's very interesting. The country that had the most rated 42, the country, one of the countries that had the least, rated number one. London was about 32, 36, something. So it's like we have our world of happiness. The ways and means we attempt to achieve happiness are so problematic. And I think it's all due to the media. Another point about the media is that we are no longer called citizens, we're called consumers. We hear talk on the radio and talk about consumers, not about citizens. So we've been reduced to consumers, so your value is in how much you can consume. And what is that consumption doing? If we consume 30 times more than India, right? Now India is becoming a growing economic power, as many countries are. Do you think there's enough resources for everyone to live on the standard that we do in America? But we've been sold this bag of tricks that accumulation equals happiness, so that's what we do. And the social pressure, well, your friends are doing that. Your friends have these clothes, these cars, they live in these places. So what does that tell us? Well, that's, they must be happy, and I need to do it. And so we don't go inside ourselves. We're always looking outside. So that's why this great saint, his name was Prahlad Maharaj, he said, yes, I've studied. And the trick to being happy is don't try, because you don't know how. Now, have you ever been out by a river or by the ocean or in a mountain or a forest and just like there's nothing there, turn off your cell phone, you have nothing and you just feel good? Anyone ever had that experience, being by the beach? You just feel good. It's like, right? So that gives us a glimpse of what spiritual happiness is. We're just with ourselves and we feel good and there's no external reason. That's what spiritual happiness is. So that's a very valuable thing to have. So we want to talk about that. And in order to do that, to understand it, we first have to understand who we are. So I'm going to do a little visualization here. I'm going to put on some music for this. And our ability to appreciate spirit... Whoops. Somebody took those CDs. Oh, the absent-minded professor has found them. I was busy last week, so my mind is in a few other places. You know how to turn this baby on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The volume very low. Where's the play button? Here? Yeah, that's better. That's play? Oh, okay. So, I'd like everyone just to close their eyes and relax in their chairs. That's good. And then, be conscious of your breath. And just relax your body and begin by relaxing your feet and focusing on your feet. If you like to sit cross-legged, you can, any way that you're comfortable, and focus on your feet and just relax your feet. And be conscious of your feet. Put your consciousness on your feet. Be conscious that you have feet. Be aware of your feet and how they feel. And now bring your consciousness up to your legs, to your shins and your calves, and relax them and focus on them. Put your awareness on your legs and how they feel. Now bring your consciousness up to your thighs. Relax your thighs and put your awareness on your thighs. Be conscious of your thighs. Bring your consciousness up to your abdomen. Be conscious of your abdomen, your stomach. Feel your stomach, put your awareness on your stomach. Bring your consciousness up to your chest. And be aware of your chest. Bring your consciousness to your arms. Be aware that you have arms and hands. And now imagine, just for a moment, that you are a torso without hands and without legs. And just be conscious of your imaginary body with no arms and no legs. Just a torso. And now your legs and your arms are back. And place your consciousness on your mind. Observe your mind. observe your thoughts. As they pass through your mind effortlessly. Perhaps you're thinking, why are we doing this? Just watch those thoughts. When is this going to end? What time is lunch? Whatever you're thinking. Just watch your thoughts. Observe your mind. Now go back in time to your earliest memories, perhaps when you were 5 or 6 or 7. And imagine that right now you have that body when you were 6 or 7, and you're looking in the mirror and you're seeing yourself. What you look like when you were very young. Perhaps imagining what you were wearing, how your hair was combed, what you look like. And you're looking at yourself in the mirror, observing that little body. Then imagine you're looking at your hands and you're looking at your feet, your little hands, your little feet. You're just observing them. So now, remember a time, or if you're at this age of 20, then you won't have to remember. If you're at the age of around 20, then come into your present body. Just be conscious of your full body. If you're older, or much older, then remember what it was like when you were 20, what you looked like. And imagine you're 20 years old now, and you're looking at yourself in the mirror, and you're looking at your body and what it looks like. And if you're that age, then just be conscious of your body as it is now. Perhaps remember the kind of thoughts you had at that age. Or if you're in your 20s, you can remember when you were 14 or 15, what you were thinking, what you looked like. And just experience what it feels like. Or what it felt like to be 15 or 20. Now imagine if you're in your 20s, what it might be like when you're 40 or 50 years old. And if you are older than that, then remember what it was like when you were 40 years old. Remember what it was like, or imagine what you might look like. You're looking in the mirror. What might you look like at the age of 40 or 50? Some gray hairs, body is bigger than it is now. It's grown. Some more wrinkles. If you're older, less wrinkles. Maybe you were slimmer. And imagine you're looking at your hands, how they're different. You're looking at your feet, you're looking at your body. What is that experience? And now imagine you're 85 years old. And you're looking at your body in the mirror. What might it look like? The wrinkles, the sunspots on the skin, the hair graying, skin sagging, muscles sagging. And what might you be thinking? Imagine you're in the body. And you're just looking at the body and you're experiencing what it's like. now imagine your body is even older and weaker. And you're laying in bed, surrounded by many friends and relatives. Your friends and relatives are lamenting because they know your days are few. And you're in this aged body. And now imagine you've left that body and you're hovering above the body. And you're looking at the body as it lays on the bed. And you're looking at your face. And you're thanking the body within for providing service for so many years, for those 80 or 90 years. And imagine now you are feeling unlimited waves of bliss, unlimited waves of love. And a divine being of infinite love is embracing you. A divine being of infinite bliss is embracing you. And now, come back to your present consciousness in your present body. Be conscious of your body. Be aware of your body. Be aware of your mind. And I would like you to repeat after me. And as you repeat, just feel what feels right for you, or feel what feels wrong for you. This is not an intellectual exercise as you repeat. Just feel how it sounds to say what I'm asking you to repeat. So please repeat. I am the body.
I am the body.
I have a body.
I have a body.
I am the body.
I am the body.
I have a body.
I have a body.
The body.
The body.
This body.
This body.
That body.
That body.
This body.
This body.
That body.
That body.
I have a 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 body.
I am the 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 mind.
I am the mind.
I have a mind.
I have a mind.
I am the mind.
I am the mind.
I have a mind.
I have a mind.
This mind.
This mind.
That mind.
That mind.
This mind.
This mind.
That mind.
That mind.
I have a self.
I have a self.
I am the self.
I am the self.
I have a self.
I have a self.
I am the self.
I am the self.
I have a self.
I have a self.
I am the self.
I am the self.
This self.
This self.
That self.
That self. So slowly open your eyes. Come back to external consciousness. Anybody like to share anything from this experience, this exercise? Any realization?
I felt happy and blissful, wanted to cry when you said that something was blissfully embracing me after death. When you made me be at my death, and I didn't want my family around. I didn't want them. They, to me, it, it started to put me in anxiety immediately. When you started bringing the people around me, I started seeing myself as my body. Then it started freaking me out because my mother was freaking out. Everybody was like, they weren't happy with it.
Interesting. Because they were seeing you, you wanted to stay in your realization of who you were, and they were kind of reinforcing.
Yeah, so I wanted them out of the room, even though you were telling them to come. It's like, what are you doing, Mom? No.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I saw myself as an old, wise woman laying in bed and having grandchildren and children. And at first, them being sad because I was leaving, but then reminding them that right now they're in me because I gave them birth just as a human. But now I will pass and now I will be inside all of them. So they would be stronger and wiser and fuller.
Did either of you have any feeling of that the people around you were lamenting for what you aren't? For they wanted to keep your body there and they were lamenting for that? That sense? There was a friend of mine who wrote a song, a very nice song, and one of the lyrics for the song is, "What I see, I am not. What I am, I do not see. What I see, I am not." So when we look at ourselves, what I am, we look at ourselves. Do we really see who we are? What I am, I do not see. And what I see, what do I see? I'm seeing my body. What I see, I am not. What I see, I am not. What I see, I am not. I do not see. So, when you look at yourself, you're not looking at yourself. But you are the person who's noticing who you are. You're the noticer. We're looking at this world, but actually what we are the ones noticing. So I notice I have a body. You noticed you have a body through this exercise, right? You were, didn't you feel that? You were the observer looking at your body and observing the changes of it. And how could you even remember the changes of your body? How could you remember what it was like when you were six? How could, unless you were different from it, you couldn't have recollection. And how could you observe the thoughts in your mind if you are the mind? You were separated from, you were looking at your mind as an observer, a noticer. So we're actually just the noticer. So while we look at ourselves in the mirror and we see the body, but the one who's seeing is noticing the body, and that's who we are. Now, what do you think, how do you think your life would be different if at this very moment you had realization that you were different from the body, that you were the observer? Like you had full realization of that. You walked out of this workshop tonight at 6 o'clock, no longer identifying that I am so-and-so, this is my name, this is my nationality, this is my age, this is my gender. You didn't think that way.
I'd be on vacation.
You'd be out here.
Be somewhat free from the constraints of. So, I think it ties into this conception that the conception is, the material conception is that we're physical. And if we're physical, then we have to satisfy ourselves through physical things, because that's what we are. And that's why we're such easy bait for the media, because we think we're physical, so they capture us. This will satisfy you physically. And because we're not physical, we end up with this problem, because we're trying, through these efforts, we're trying to satisfy ourselves physically. And what happens? You satisfy it for a little while, but then it doesn't really work. You didn't get the itch. You missed it. Because you missed who you were. So, I would like us to ponder for a moment, which I think is very, very valuable. What are the ramifications of understanding that we're different from the body? How would that play out? How does that play out? If you have a clear understanding, you're different from the body, what would the ramifications be? Not necessarily you realize it, as I was saying before, but just that you understand that, what ramifications does that have?
I mean, if you're depressed, your first thought won't be, let me inject myself with chemicals to, snap out of it.
And there's something amazing right along this line. There was a lady who went in for guidance, for counseling, for therapy. She was very depressed. So the counselor was a spiritualist, so he said, how long have you been noticing that you're depressed? She said, for 20 years. And then he said, how does the noticer feel? Separated one stage beyond the depression within the mind. You're noticing the mind is depressed. How do you feel as the noticer? You want to say?
I was just saying ramification would be that I would have to consider ways to satisfy my needs or my feeling of need that would be separate from the body.
Yeah. So it means there's two needs. Most people just think there's one need, which is just the body, right? And then so you feel this emptiness because you're missing the spiritual side of it. And so the body, obviously, it has needs. You have to feed it. You have to clothe it, keep it warm and healthy, shelter it. So those are needs. In America, 30 times more, we pamper our body 30 times more than the average Indian. Of course, they're catching up quickly. But still, we're like 5 times ahead of most places. Right? Isn't it? In the pampering of the body. But a materialistic culture will tend to ignore pampering or taking care of the soul, and it'll just pamper the body. So it creates this. That's where depression comes from. When you have everything and you're not happy. It's worse, at least if you don't have everything and you're not happy, you think, well, it's because I don't have everything. But once you finally get it and you're not happy, it's actually worse. So what's another ramification of knowing we're not the body? In regards to this?
It seems slightly problematic if you need a voice, a tongue, and fingers, and do your job. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Okay. So the body is the vehicle. The body is the vehicle, but you're the driver. So you take care of the vehicle, and you use the vehicle for uplifting the driver. Or you use it to degrade the driver. Now there's, I think it's important to note, it's a very interesting concept. Some of you already know this. The nature of the soul. Anandini, do you know what your name means?
Eternal bliss.
How many of you would like eternal bliss? Well, now, we are souls in a body, so what's the nature of the soul? According to all the teachings of the great teachers and great spiritual books, the nature of the soul is that it is sat. Who knows what sat means? It's a couple of things.
Eternality.
Eternality. Sat actually also means real. But it's eternal. But let's just look at that. It said that when you realize who you are, you become happy. Well, one of the reasons you become happy is because you realize you don't die. So nobody wants to die. Nobody in their right mind wants to die. And when I first learned Bhagavad Gita, I had a problem with death because it didn't make sense to me that I was going to live in this world for whatever, 70, 80 years, that I was going to die and not exist. And that thought perplexed me. I was trying to figure out what sense does that make. And the only sense it made to me is that if this life was like a utopia, then I got my 100 years of utopia, and then that's it. It's finished. I was like, okay, that kind of made sense. All right. But this life isn't utopia. So then I thought, well, if it's 70, 80 years, and it's not all utopia, I mean, like 40 of it I'm going to be working, and I might work at a job I don't even like. You know, and another how many years I spend 8 hours a day sleeping, times, you know, so what is it, another 20 years, you know, sleeping, you know, it's like, it's not all fun and games. So it did make sense to me, and I thought, me as an individual will no longer exist. It's just like, just driving me crazy. It just bothered me so much. I said, why did God create me to not exist? And then punish me in between, you know. Or send me women who punish me. I had a lot of those, right? Or made me act towards women so they would punish me. So when I first heard this, it said, you are soul and the soul is eternal. I just became really happy. I said, yes, it's got to be. It's got to be. You can't be. You know, it doesn't make sense. So they say when you realize who you are, that's one of the symptoms. Because now you realize this whole problem of dying is not a problem anymore because you don't die. Now, in Christianity, they say that eternity starts within this life, right? But in Indian philosophy, eternality is what it means. It's always, you always existed. So what you are today is the product of thousands of lifetimes. You're not, you know, your idiosyncrasies, you didn't just get them when you were a baby. You didn't just pick them up from your mother and father. You are a product of thousands of lifetimes of evolution. And that's why when you'll see any kind of discourse on spiritual teachings, some people will have no interest because they haven't evolved there yet. Where other people are like, I'm there, because they've already evolved in the past. And so there's a natural, you know, it's just like they're in graduate school now, where someone else is a freshman. So what I think a lot of you probably noticed that when you were very young, you had a lot of spiritual thoughts. They weren't necessarily things that you had to learn. They were already there. You notice that when you were young? When I was young, I used to climb on the fences behind my house. Like I was 8 years old. It was just, we were on a hill, so there was a fence in our backyard, and then the next property was like the top of that fence. So I could climb on fences. I guess girls don't do this. Do they? Climb down the street on fences, unless they're, maybe they do now, but I didn't see any girls on the way when I was climbing fences. I was like 8 years old, and I was on these fences, and if I fell, I was going to get hurt because they're about 8 feet high. And my thought was, God's going to protect me. I was like, and my parents never told me that. They weren't that religious. But no one ever told me that, and I had that idea. So where did that come from? It wasn't cultivated in that lifetime. I didn't read it in a book. No one told me that. It's just intuitive. So we are works in progress. We are the results of thousands of lifetimes of learning. And there's so many things that you're going to learn in this life and they stay with you. And it's the evolution of consciousness. In your next life, you're going to continue. Or maybe you won't have a next life. And we'll talk about that later. But if you don't make it, right, if you fail in the class, you can take it over again. Now the next one, Chit. I mean, it's good to know that there's not a God who burns you forever. I mean, at least if he just burned you up, that's, you know, okay, that would be bad enough. But to burn and not burn, that's like, it's good to know that he doesn't do that. Now, Chit, who knows what Chit means?
Knowledge.
Chit means knowledge. And my spiritual master said this is
It means that when we're born in the world, we're born into ignorance, we have to get educated, but inside of us, as the nature of the soul is illuminating. The soul is conscious, it's aware. That's who we are. So when we uncover or we become pure, we become enlightened. The knowledge is there, it's coming out. It's not that you're going to realize something that's not already there within you, just as when you realize your eternity, it's because you are. So he used to say, we're full of knowledge. Or another way of saying is, we're full of chit. So turn to the person next to you and tell them, you're full of chit. You guys are totally full of chit. So we will have our t-shirts soon. You're full of chit t-shirts.
I'll wear it.
Everyone who comes will definitely want to buy them. Okay, and then Ananda, so Anandini told us what Ananda means. It means bliss. Now, what is important is to realize in understanding this whole dilemma of happiness that bliss is not on this chart. It's not a better kind of happiness. It's in a different league. It has nothing to do with material happiness. It's like when you think of material happiness, you kind of envision, well, you know, I have this and this, and if I was doing that, and this is in place, and this much money in the bank, and I lived here. You know, it's kind of like everybody has their dream, right? I grew up by the beach, so my dream is, you know, a house by the beach. And a big bank account so I don't have to work. You know, then I'll be in bliss. So we all have these visions, but this bliss has nothing to do with that. And in the Bhagavad Gita, there's this verse that impressed me so much, and it still impresses me. It's been the first time I heard it. It said that the spiritualists, when they get to this platform, they think, there's nothing better than this. Once having achieved this, there's nothing better. Could you imagine getting to that point? You think, this is it. It doesn't get any better than this. So why do they think that way? Because it's not material happiness. Because you know, whatever you get materially, then what do you have to do? You have to protect it. Right? What if my husband or wife cheats on me? What if my investments go down? There's always this anxiety. So you think, well, let's make another billion. You know. Maybe line up a few girlfriends in case my wife cheats on me. You know, what you're always calculating, right? Balancing everything. So if you understand this, that it's a different category than this. If you understand, this is the itch. This is what has to be scratched. And then if you understand, even more importantly, this is who you are. And if this is who you are, then why would you look anywhere else outside yourself? You know that example? You know that the scent of musk? Where is the scent of musk found?
Navel of the musk deer.
The navel of the musk deer. So it's a attractive scent, but the musk deer doesn't know that it's in his navel. So he goes looking for it. So he looks around for that scent, not knowing that it's in his navel. So we're very much like that. We're looking for happiness, just like the deer, not knowing that we are happiness. Now, in meditating on this, I began thinking that when we were created by God, He didn't have to make us Ananda. What's the opposite of Ananda? In Sanskrit, it's called Nirananda. It doesn't mean close to Ananda. Nir means the opposite.
Lamentation.
Yeah, just no bliss. Yeah, lamentation. Misery, pain. So just imagine, what if God created our essential nature to be misery? That was our nature. So that any time we got in touch with ourself, we would suffer. And so that the whole goal of life was to alienate yourself from yourself and douse yourself with things to forget who you are. And that way you could be happy.
It's called taking antidepressants.
That's the American way.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, yeah, that's what people think. Yeah,
my natural life is so miserable, I have to forget it. But fortunately, he created us to be blissful, which is quite a nice gift if you think about it, isn't it? That if you uncover that nature, you will be satisfied. That's the way he created us. And he created us that whatever we need to know, if we purify ourselves, we will need to know it. And that we don't die, which is... When I first heard that I didn't die, I said, this is the best thing I've heard all day. Because I was completely... I just had such a big issue with that. So this made sense of it. So now the question is, if this is who we are, then why aren't we there? And how to get there? Would you like to know how?
Yeah.
Only two of you want to know? The rest of you want to stay where you want? Well.
After lunch.
Oh, yeah. There's lunch here?
Yeah.
Oh, so we'll keep you in suspense. So how you get there is you eat lunch. And I'll tell you why. I have to tell you why. For those of you who don't know, I have to tell you why you get there by eating lunch. And I'll tell you a few stories. That in the tradition of bhakti, bhakti is a devotional tradition. In the tradition of bhakti, the concept of bhakti is that everything you do should be a connection or a yoga with God. So you can't do anything and say, well, this is just for me and this is for God. That's how religion works, right? You go to church and that's for God, and then you go home and football game's for me and this is for God. And so in bhakti, everything's connected. So the teachings of bhakti tell us, and Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, everything you do, you should do it for me, including everything you eat. Right? So how do you do that? So we have learned that we are highly affected by what we eat. And most of you know that. If you don't know that, you all know that, right? You eat the wrong thing, you get sleepy, you get cloudy, sometimes you don't even realize it. And you eat foods that agitate your mind and you're angry and you don't know why. There are certain foods that do that. They're called onions and garlic, in case you don't know. They actually have that effect. People don't know that. So people who practice yoga generally stay away from foods like that. And what they do, they cook food in the consciousness that before this food is eaten, it's going to be offered as a sacrifice, an offering. And so when they're cooking it, they're thinking, I'm not cooking for myself, but I'm cooking to offer. And so they don't eat it, they don't taste it. It's a different consciousness. Now my spiritual master said, whoever cooks your food, whatever they're thinking, their consciousness is transferred into that. And you eat it and you pick up their consciousness. And people go, we'll say, well, how is that? How's that possible? Well, if you look at a painting, don't you pick up the consciousness of the artist? What is he thinking? Do you hear classical music? My wife does, my daughter does violin. So we go to these recitals of her teacher sometimes. And some of these pieces, when I hear them, I go, this composer was crazy. The music is mad. It's all mad. It's making my mind agitated and disturbing. I can't even follow the music. It's just like it's going all over and all these emotions. But this guy was a maniac. You can feel it in his music. Can't you? Right, so it's being the consciousness of the artist is being transferred through their work. In the same way, the consciousness of the person cooking is actually being transferred in the food. So a tradition in India amongst what are called Brahmins or the priestly caste is they will only cook their own food. They won't let anybody else cook it. Maybe they'll let their mother cook it. Mm-hmm. So we say good old mama's cooking. Why? Because there's love there. There's something you can feel it, right? So, in bhakti, the bhakti tradition, we offer with prayer and mantra the food that we cook. And so it becomes spiritualized, and the food also becomes blissful. And so when you eat it, it actually makes you blissful. And we have had many, many experiences with this, of people that were not very spiritual, who even in some ways against spiritual teachings, when they would eat food offered spiritual food, it's called prasadam, it would change them. And they would calm down. And they would be open. Now, we've also found another phenomenon. I found this in my teachings, in that what you eat affects your consciousness. And there's a connection between eating animals and consciousness because there's violence connected. So it has that effect. And if you want to see a nightmare, just look at any of the PETA videos that show you what goes on in the slaughterhouses. And before the animals get to the slaughterhouses, as soon as you see it, you can't. It's so sickening. I don't. If you're already vegetarian, I wouldn't recommend seeing it. But if you're not, I would. Because when you realize what you're connected to, it just would stop. It's so bad, the way they're treated. It's horrible. It's beyond inhumane. So when we have a connection with that violence, it affects our consciousness. So what I ask people to do who are eating meat, I say, well, just don't eat meat for a week and see what happens. Or 2 weeks. And every person, after the week or two, I'd say, what happened? I say, by not eating the meat, I said, I became compassionate upon the animals. Because before, they would say, well, what's the problem? It's just animal, it's food. I said, just don't eat it and see what happens. It changed their consciousness. Every time. It's, I've become sensitive now. So there is a connection with what we eat. And so we're eating spiritual food then. Now I have to say one more thing about this because it's so important. What's the difference between a pet and an animal for food? Okay, tell me the difference.
Attachment?
Yeah? You have to draw a line somewhere. Like the pet, you're attached, right? Of course, some people are attached to eating certain kinds of foods. So, according to, let's say, the level of attachment that we as a society have for certain animals, like in our society, we have attachment for dogs. But in Chinese society, dogs are food. So when we hear that in America, we go, oh my God, how could they do that? Right? But in Chinese society, it's normal because they've made a demarcation between what food is and what a pet is. So every society makes a demarcation. Right? And it's a little different. Right? We have made demarcations. So cows are food, lamb is food, pigs are food, what else? Chickens are food, fish are food. We make a demarcation. But in some societies, the line where you draw it changes. And it's not based on a scriptural or a spiritual teaching. It's just we as a society decided we believe these animals are food and we believe these animals are pets. Right. So in fully spiritual societies, where does the line get between pet and food? Where is the line? Right? The line is moved all the way to the right, so everything is pet. And no animal is food. And then the more in societies that don't have that spiritual basis, they just move the line according to what they think is right. And we don't move it to dogs. And if you went and killed a dog because you were hungry, you can't do that. Right? But in China, this person went to, in Hong Kong, a person went to a restaurant and they had a dog. And they asked the maitre d' outside to take care of the dog, thinking that they would tie the dog up. And then they ate their meal and they came out for the dog. Said, where's the dog? And they said, you ate the dog. So because that's what the maitre d' said, take care of the dog means.
Oops.
Because we eat dogs. So
wow.
You bring the dog to the restaurant, they cook it. In some countries, they eat rats. And in some countries, they put rats in a vat and they decompose. And that becomes...
Do you need to have this conversation before the mission?
That becomes... Well, that's a bad one. It's like social conditioning. Should I get worse? Cockroaches? Insects? Mm-hmm. So I'm just reading a story about someone was in a restaurant somewhere in some country. They were looking at this cake. Insect cake. So we look at that and go, oh my God, how could we do that? It just doesn't make any sense. So spiritual society will draw the line as far as possible. So anyway, so the food that we're eating, not only is it not meat, but it's been spiritualized. And it's very good. It's made from very yummy things, like appetizing things. And there's no harm to any animal. And as far as possible, people who are spiritual will raise in generally in countries, in traditional environments, everybody has their own animals, so they take care of them. So the animals aren't exploited. So that's what you're going to eat. So that's one way to become blissful. Okay? You're all ready to eat?
Yeah,
what?
We're all ready to come.
Okay, let's go. So, you line up there, get a place, and serve yourself, or we're going to serve, or what?
Well, I'll